From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. John Hughes has seen his share of conflict. As a journalist, he covered the war in Vietnam, the Cold War struggles between the U.S. and Soviet Union, a civil war in Indonesia. He won a Pulitzer for that story. And he was front and center in a dispute between the Salt Lake Tribune and the Deseret News. The Des wanted to be a morning paper. The Trib was standing in the way. Now, that last part pales in comparison to the others, maybe, but it's still a pretty interesting chapter in a very interesting life. Hughes became the first non-Mormon editor of the Deseret News. In a new memoir, he writes about the experience, and today on the program, he'll join us. We'll talk about that Utah chapter, but there's a lot more there, too. John Hughes today, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So let's let John Hughes' resume be the introduction to the show today. Hughes has written a memoir about his life as a journalist, and he's with us today to talk about it. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's covered Africa, the Far East, Southeast Asia, the Soviet Union. He was the editor for the Christian Science Monitor, a journalism professor. He was an assistant secretary of state for public affairs for the United States, assistant secretary general for the United Nations. But most of you came to know John Hughes when he was chosen to be editor of the Deseret News, the first non-Mormon editor of that paper. John Hughes is joining us today to talk about his book, which is called Paperboy to Pulitzer, A Newsman's Journey. John Hughes these days is he's still at it. He's a professor of communications at Brigham Young University. He's joining us here in the studio. And John Hughes, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's a big list.
I've been at it a long time.
Yes, you have. I want to back into this conversation for a moment first, because there's a lot to talk about, obviously, and I want to get to your early life. But I want to just back up a minute and talk about something that you write about, your relationship with the Deseret News, which we'll come to later in the program. But I want to start here because you had been asked, you were teaching at Brigham Young University, and you were asked if you would do some consulting for the Deseret News. They were in a position of trying to increase the circulation and improve the quality of the paper, those kinds of things. And so you made a recommendation. You made 39, as a matter of fact, recommendations to the Deseret News. Now, we'll come to that as we go, but after this process, they said, oh, by the way, would you be the editor to implement these? Now, I wanted to ask you about one of the big questions you had to them. It's an obvious question, clearly, for a journalist, and that is, what's the relationship going to be like between the editorial arm of the Deseret News that you'd be in charge of and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who owns the paper? Start there. What was that? Was that a big concern for you?
Sure. It was, you know, would be whatever I worked was when I was with a Christian Science Monitor. You want to know what degree of freedom you're going to have, or do you have people telling you to do this and telling you to do that?
Yeah.
So I posed that question to Glenn Snarr, who was a wonderful man, chairman of the Board of Trustees. And he said, I think you better go talk to President Hinckley about that. And who's president of the church?
Of course, Gordon B. Hinckley.
And Gordon B. And that was set up for me. And my wife was invited. My wife is a Mormon. I am not. But my wife was invited to join me, and I met with President Hinckley and his advisors, and had a wonderful, frank discussion with him. He loved newspapers, and he understood newspapers. And I said, you know, what degree of freedom do you think I might be having? And he said, well, we can't have people over here in the church building telling you what to do. So I said that was a good answer from my point of view.
Did you believe it?
Yeah, I did.
Did you?
I did, yes, because I trusted him. He was very frank and very open. I mean, we'd had discussions about what he wanted the paper to be. We'd had discussions about how long I would stay doing it, it was a good, frank discussion. And indeed, for the 10 years I was editor of the Deseret News, I never had a call from a church official saying, please do this or please do that. In some respects, it was very similar to my time at the Christian Science Monitor, mm-hmm. which was also owned by a church.
Of course.
When I was at the Monitor, I asked the same questions and got the same answers and got the same promises, which were kept. But they did say, but we like the editorials where you're stating the policy of the paper. We like someone on our board to
have a look.
Have a look.
Yeah.
And we sent them over in the all the years I was with the Monitor as editor. And the procedure at the Deseret News happened to be identical. Would you mind sending the editorials up to a certain official, one of the 12, in fact?
Right.
And that's what I did. All that happened in my entire career at the Christian Science Monitor. After 6 months at the Deseret News, I got a call from across the street and said, don't bother sending them over anymore. We're fine.
Did you feel good about that, though? I mean, on one hand, if you're a journalist, don't you want there to be a little bit of unease by the organization that if the organization is involved in social matters or matters that your reporters are covering, don't you want them to be a little uneasy about that relationship?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. I did say to President Hinckley, Mr. President Hinckley, you are an extremely wise man, and I apologize for asking this question, but might you not be making a terrible mistake by appointing the first non-Mormon editor of the paper? And his very words were, no, you've lived among us. We trust you. You know, go ahead. That was an extraordinarily wonderful answer to that question. And, we discussed all kinds of other things. But, you know, people think that when a new editor comes in, you chart new policies in major issues. Well, you know, you don't. There's a lot of background to any newspaper. They've taken stands on this and that and the other. And if you're going to be an editor of the Deseret News, you're not going to have editorials promoting gambling. You're not going to having editorials promoting drinking. You know, it's not science, you know.
Not rocket science.
It's not rocket science. It's a long history of positions of the paper.
Well, let's back up. We'll come back to this story as we work our way through your life. You're born in Wales to,
yep.
to working class parents.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Your father worked in a steel mill for a time, mm-hmm. but you say his real passion was cars.
Automobiles. Yeah. He and his brother brought the first automobile to the little town of Neath, South Wales, which was his home. Family had a horse, and he and his brother prevailed on their mother to take the horse to Cardiff, about 30 miles away, and trade it for a car. They traded for a car. Cars in those days were not very reliable. On the way home, the car broke down. So they hitchhiked back to Cardiff, borrowed the horse back that they traded, and towed the first car to the town of Neath, South Wales.
Do you remember much about that? I mean, you left when you were
in
Wales.
No, I lived in London most of the time.
Yeah, most of the time. So you don't remember that much. But you do tell the story. Your grandmother had an interesting place of business. It was called an inn, but nobody really slept there.
It was a pub. It was a pub. It had this marvelous name, Prince of Wales Inn, but it was a pub, yeah.
Your parents were drawn back to Wales, you say, on special occasions from time to time. I guess you went to see relatives and you went on holiday, those kinds of things. But it was really in London where, a suburb anyway of London, North London, Hornsey, I guess it's called, is where you really grew up.
Yep.
And there are a couple of things I wanted to ask you about that. One of them is books.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you still have an obsession with books, but it must have started then.
I don't know when it started, but it certainly is existing to the chagrin of my wife at the moment because my study's packed.
Yeah.
I've got an encyclopedia which nobody has anymore because you get it on the web, and she wants me to get rid of them. But I say no, because you just never know, and they look nice, and I love them, so there you go. She's not making much headway in getting my books cleared out.
Well, you were young. Libraries? Did you go to libraries a lot,
yeah,
or did your parents just get you books? I mean,
they
were working class
folks. I went to a very nice high school.
Right.
Got a fellow scholarship for that, and there was a lot of good teachers and a lot of good instruction and a lot of very great library there too.
This is the other interesting part. I had no idea, but there was a time there where the trajectory of your life, John Hughes, was headed for fame and fortune. Possibly, I mean, you. You got a part in a movie.
Yes, it did. Yeah.
When you were 8 years old, you did. Now, you were a handsome kid.
I don't think that had anything to do with it.
Well, you did some modeling, right?
I did do some modeling. Yes. That started after the movie.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Guy who lived next door to us in London came into our house and said to my mother, "Can John put on a Welsh accent?" And you know, my mother said, "Well, yeah, I guess so. You know, he's lived around Welsh people, yes, and he can." And he asked me a few questions as a reply in a Welsh brogue, and I did. And so he said, "Well, we're doing this movie, and it's about Wales, and it's about the star was a guy called Paul Robeson.
Paul Robeson, yeah, a great
famous
American
singer.
Yeah, black.
And the story was he came to Wales and faced as much discrimination there as he did in the United States."
Yeah.
But he broke it down because he had this marvelous singing voice, and he was in terms of the choir. And then the story, there's a collapse in the mine, and Paul Robeson saves all these people who are not nice to him at one stage, and there you go. And I was a kid in that movie, yeah.
Did you... Were you starstruck? I mean, did you want this kind of life?
Not particularly, but I thought it was fun. You know, I'd never been on a movie set before, and there were other kids involved too. And Paul Robeson used to dangle us on his lap, you know, and sing for us and all the rest of it. So it was fun while they weren't shooting.
But then you tell the story, Roddy McDowall, the actor. I don't know if you were competing for a role, but you talk about that. Your seems like your acting career kind of came to an end when you blew an audition.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Roddy was doing what I was doing. You know, you sort of get under this circuit where they call you for pictures for this ad and so forth and so on. And so we'd worked a bit like that together, and then suddenly I was called for an audition in How Green Was My Valley, which they were going to shoot. And I blew it, and he won, and he went on to stardom in Hollywood, and I went into journalism, which was probably the better thing for me to do.
You know, it's interesting, you weren't particularly, at least I don't get a sense that you were particularly religious, at least initially growing up, and you say your parents were Welsh Baptists for a time, not terribly active, I didn't get a sense from the book, but sometime in the 1930s, you write that your mother took this job to make ends meet as a housekeeper. To a family who were Christian Scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess this really changed your family's life.
Yeah, it absolutely did. My mother, mum and dad became members of the Christian Science Church. They'd never been heavy drinkers, but they stopped drinking and stopped smoking. My mother had smoked and joined the Christian Science Church. And when my dad was in World War II, he worked a lot with a Christian Science chaplain in North Africa. He was with Montgomery's 8th Army for 3 years in North Africa.
You know, it's interesting to hear you tell this story. Your father was basically he volunteered or was conscripted.
He didn't volunteer. He was conscripted. He was 40 something.
He was 40 years old. Yeah, more than 40 years old.
They took every man who could walk, and that's where he went.
But he was a Christian Scientist at the time. Had his particular sort of religious worldview. And I remember there's a part in the book where you talk about how. You were disturbed by the fact that I'm sure that your father was leaving, obviously.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
Also you must have been concerned about what war would mean for a man like your father, because you tell the story of asking him if he had to, could he kill a man? Tell that story.
Well, that is exactly the question I asked him, and he said, "I've thought about that a lot." And he said, I've decided that if it's the nearest right, I can do that." And he said, I feel it's the nearest right because the Nazi regime in Germany is taking over countries that don't belong to them and killing people that shouldn't be killed. And it's an evil that has to be eliminated. And I guess, you know, I'm not crazy about going into the army, but I don't think I can refuse to go into the army, and I don't think I could refuse to kill someone who was trying to do damage to our country.
Did that come in conflict with Christian Science ideas?
No, I don't think so. I think Christian Scientists joined up just like anybody else. Like.
Your first regular job, you were a paper boy.
Yeah.
You delivered newspapers.
Yeah.
And you say in the book that this experience gave you your first exposure to the strengths and the weaknesses of journalism. Yeah. In what way?
Well, because at that time in London, there were about 8 or 9 good daily papers, the Times of London, the Telegraph, the Daily Express, the Daily Mail, the News Chronicle, the Daily Mirror, if you were a lowbrow, the Manchester Guardian, if you were highbrow. And I had to deliver the right newspapers to the right people. And if you delivered the wrong newspaper, you caught Mary you-know-what. And it was a good lesson about how people get addicted to newspapers they trust. And they make decisions about newspapers they buy. This is back when we had print newspapers.
Yeah. But you got a sort of a deep working sense of reader habits.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you were delivering papers, this was before you became ultimately a journalist.
Oh, yeah.
Had you thought about did that make you want to be a journalist?
Well, my next nudge in the direction of journalism was the voice school I went to, where experiments I were to undertake in the physics lab exploded, and then the chemistry lab exploded. And my physics and chemistry masters said, you know, it probably would be a good thing to avoid that because I obviously had no talent for this. But my English master said, I think you can write. And I think you ought to go to the London University Journalism School when you get out of here. But I never did because my dad came home from the war and said, we're moving to South Africa, where he'd stopped on the way to North Africa. They put him on, they had to take convoy up the east coast of Africa to avoid German subs going through the Straits of Gibraltar. And he was on land under canvas for 6 weeks in Cape Town while they were forming the convoy. And he kind of liked it.
Yeah.
And he also met with this South African resident who was a chaplain, Christensen's chaplain, who said, come on to South Africa after the war. Get rid of rainy England and come to sunny South Africa. So that's where I went, and that's where I first started on a newspaper.
A lot of ex-servicemen were, you say, leaving for South Africa, leaving
Canada,
for Canada,
Australia,
those kinds of places.
Yeah.
Why do you think?
Well, part climate.
Yeah, you know,
they came back to a climate that they'd just been under.
Doesn't explain Canada, but.
Doesn't place Canada, but, there was turmoil, there was lack of jobs, there was readjustment, and it just seemed that the horizons were wider in some of those other countries.
This is where your first job in journalism came,
yeah.
Was in South Africa.
Yeah.
The Natal Mercury.
The Natal Mercury in Durban, South Africa, about 50,000, 60,000 circulation morning paper. Yeah.
I want you to tell us about Alex Hammond. He was your first editor.
He was my first editor, like God.
Is that right?
Yeah, like God. And and if you're 17 years old, he was a white South African back from the war, a war hero, bronzed, handsome. And you sort of felt that when you started working for Alex Hammond, you were joining the priesthood, you know, because that's how he felt about journalism. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he said, if you can think of nothing else but the Natal Mercury, if you can sleep the Natal Mercury, eat the Natal Mercury, I can make a journalist of you. And my first assignment, he said, but we've got to teach you, got to go to shorthand school. So I went to shorthand school to learn shorthand with a bunch of young ladies.
The only man in that.
I was the only man in that particular class, yes. And I came back. And my first assignment for Alex Hammond was to go to cover a Scottish nuclear physicist who was giving a rotary address. And off I went, and I opened my notebook, and I forgot my pencil ready. And the speaker opened his mouth. He's a Scotsman. And he said, nuclear throwaway. And I thought, oh, my. Goodness, I don't understand. I can't understand him. He's rogue. And B, I don't know anything about nuclear physics. But afterwards, I grabbed him and said, you know, hey, my life depends on being able to. You got to explain this.
Well, you were terrified. You didn't want to. You didn't want to disappoint Alex Hammond.
I was not going to mess up my first assignment for Alex Hammond. And he was a wonderful editor. He died about 10 years later of cancer. But he was, you know. He just demanded ethics and accuracy and doing the right thing. He was just a great first editor for me.
So that was kind of your basis for this idea of ethics and objectivity and depth.
Sure,
Alex Hammond.
Yeah.
John Hughes is with us. His new memoir, it's called Paperboy to Pulitzer, A Newsman's Journey. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a conversation with John Hughes, former Deseret News editor. Hughes has had a distinguished career as a journalist, won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the turmoil in Indonesia. He has published a memoir of his life, and he's joining us to talk about it. It's called Paperboy to Pulitzer, A Newsman's Journey, joining us here in the studio. I wanted to ask you about, you came from, when you were in South Africa, you came from a mostly white neighborhood in London, born in a mostly white community in Wales, of course, went to an all-white boys' school. So it must have been, I don't know if it was a shock, but certainly an adjustment and certainly a challenge to confront and write about politics or the social issues that were related to race, I imagine.
Yeah, it was. And it was very good for me. I mean, because, as you say, I'd come from a pretty lily-white background and in Durban, and it was some multinational, multiracial people, a large African population, large Indian population, too, because Indian folks had come from across the ocean and was bid to work there in the rice fields and so forth and so on. And it was, of course, my first contact with a white, an Afrikaans, particularly white, government that was terribly restricting blacks. They didn't get a vote. They couldn't vote wherever, they couldn't live wherever they wanted to live. You had to have a pass if they were coming in from the outlying districts. And the police special branch was very, very tough. I mean, they were very tough on anybody who was talking about freedom, on emancipation, getting the vote, and moving non-whites along. It was a white-controlled government. Natal province, which was where I was, where Durban was located, was a little more English rather than Afrikaans. But nevertheless, discrimination prevailed there too. And it was an eye-opener.
Mm. To ask you about what made you want to write a memoir? One of the things we were sort of chatting about a little bit off air there was the difficulty of a journalist who has to be pretty careful about guarding his or her opinions, keeping them to themselves.
Right.
And now all of a sudden somebody suggests to you, why don't you write a memoir? I'm not sure your idea was somebody else's, but either way, it was a project that you were taking on now, and I'm wondering if you felt – was it hard to shift gears that way? Because it seems like it is.
Well, it's a different kind of writing because you're 800 words quick off the trigger. That's what you're about doing most of your life.
Yeah. And lots of personal pronouns.
And now you've got to do a little thinking about what you want to talk about and when and why you want to do it, actually. And I wanted to do it for two reasons. I wanted to – sounds corny, but I wanted to write a love story about journalism in my changing profession. You know, print is in decline, but nevertheless, journalism prevails. And I wanted to give heart to young journalists who shouldn't throw in the towel because the means of delivery is changing. But I also wanted to talk to my grandchildren. I've got five grandchildren at the moment, and they haven't the faintest idea. You know what I'd done. And my son has written a couple of books too, but he's not a journalist. He's a techie guy and an entrepreneurial guy and understands all kinds of things about marketing that I don't understand. And he said, "Hey, didn't you deliver papers when you were a kid in London?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You know, you could write a good book about coming from a paper boy to something." And he said, "You know, to the Pulitzer." And I said, "Yeah, I could probably do something about that." And that's how it started.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. I have to say, one thing I noticed in the book is you say very little about the fact that you became later as an adult, I'm sure influenced obviously by your parents, you became a Christian Scientist yourself. Now, I may be wrong about this, but there's one sentence in there about you being a Christian Scientist. Is that why?
I don't know. I mean, it's like being a Methodist, I guess, or being a Presbyterian.
Really? You didn't think it was and the reason I ask this is because you did, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this. There is this interesting parallel going on between the story we started with, you know, between the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Mm-hmm. What's the relationship like with the Deseret News, which was a different thing when you were editor. We'll
yes.
talk about that too than it is now. But that relationship is interesting. You became, of course, a very distinguished editor of the Christian Science Monitor, had a relationship with the church. But you don't really say much about your relationship with Christian Science. Did you want to sort of keep that away? You know, you weren't
no,
quite
no,
to
no.
Say
I mean, I was in Sunday school, in the Christian Science Sunday school. I suspect I was in, I guess I was about 9 years old. In 1939, when war broke out, I was in Sunday school the day it was in Naval Chamber and said, we're at war. Hmm. And I've been a member of the church all my life, and it's been a wonderful experience. There is a sort of interesting connection between the Mormon Church and the Christian Science Church where journalism is concerned. And I didn't know this until after I'd become editor of the Deseret News. And I learned that many years before, and the people at the Christian Science Church couldn't remember who they were, but she thought they were the 12 apostles. Now, I don't know whether the 12 apostles went to Boston, but apparently a senior delegation from the Mormon Church went to Boston there to meet with the Christian Science Board of Directors to talk about a church owning a newspaper and what advice. Now, I never knew this until years afterwards, but it was a nice little connection.
I wonder what that relationship was. At some point, you say that you were determined to work for the Christian Science Monitor. And not only that, this seems extraordinary. It seems like you took this leap of faith. I mean, you started in South Africa, you went to Fleet Street,
right.
Came back to South Africa,
right.
And then took this leap of faith. You sort of sold, not sold everything, but sold a lot of things, got on a, was a freighter?
No. You read the piece that Lee Benson did on me, and I tweaked him afterwards.
Oh, you did? Okay.
It wasn't a freighter. It was a liner, and I paid my way.
Okay. Well, but look, it's so extraordinary.
I tweaked Lee after that. Lee said, "Oh my goodness!"
But you didn't have a job at the time. I'm going to go to Boston and try to get a job.
Well,
I'd
written some stuff for the Monitor from South Africa,
right.
And some of it they'd used, and some of it they hadn't. It's the usual thing, you know. But I was freelancing for two newspapers in London too. But the Monitor, I mean, when I was reading the Monitor in our house, it just seemed to me that this was a serious newspaper covering serious national and but particularly international news, and I think I was kind of drawn to that.
The church was founded by a woman named Mary Baker Eddy.
Right.
Who also founded the newspaper.
Yes.
And it's interesting because the paper has always had this reputation for good journalism, for mm-hmm. objectivity, despite that, you know, sort of the basic sort of seeming conflict between
yeah.
the fact that it's owned by a church. But Mary Baker Eddy said this when the paper was started, that the goal would be this, to injure no man,
right.
But to bless all mankind.
That's right. And that doesn't mean, it didn't mean through the life of the paper, and it still exists, that doesn't mean looking at the world through rose-tinted spectacles. It means where there is evil, where there is disaster, where there is, you know, terrible, terrible situation, to report on it and report on it frankly. But ideally, to offer some hope where there is hope and pay attention to good works and techniques for resolving some of those terrible problems.
It just seems so interesting that there would be such a deep sensibility about the world. And I guess it makes sense, but that this would come from a religious perspective, this devotion to deep coverage of issues, journalism.
Yeah, I think Mary Baker Eddy was not terribly ecstatic about the newspapers of the day in 1908. I think that is part of it, too.
She saw them as sort of yellow journalism tabloid.
Yeah, and she said, yeah. there ought to be. And of course, it was an extraordinary thing for a woman, a woman church leader to come out one day and tell her lieutenants, we're going to start a newspaper and we're going to do it right away. But they did, and it worked.
So you get on this liner that you paid for, go to Boston to basically interview for this job, the Christian Science Monitor.
Yep.
And you went before this legendary man, editor, Irwin Canham.
Irwin Canham, yeah.
Lifelong Christian scientist.
Yep.
It's interesting. I read that he taught a Sunday school class not far from where the paper was. So he was himself a part of the church,
yep.
But also an extraordinary man and an extraordinary editor.
Yeah.
Talk about that when you went, you must have been terrified, right?
No, I wasn't terrified, because I wasn't going to go in there and say, I'm terrified. I went in there and said, you know, I'm really good, and you ought to hire me. You can't be modest when I tell my students, you can't be modest.
Yeah.
He was a great guy. He actually came from a relatively humble background himself. His father ran a small weekly newspaper in Maine. But Irwin was very, very bright, became a Rhodes Scholar. Became president of American Society Newspaper Editors, moved with presidents and prime ministers, went abroad and so forth and so on. And he was just very sharp and very good.
You know, I think that we mentioned that the paper sort of distinguished itself for really good, thoughtful journalism. And I'd read Canham once talked about, I think he was a little bit like Mary Baker Eddy in the sense that he was seemed to be worried about, because I read this thing where he was, the advent of radio and television, he said, meant that newspapers kind of had to step up their game and go beyond what he called, I read this, the mere reporting of the event. He said the job of the press, the job of newspapers, is to take reporting more deeply and widely. So clearly, again, here was another influence, I guess must have been for you, that you sensed that this is about depth.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly the monitor.
I wanted to ask you about the relationship then. Now we were talking about between the paper and Christian Science. So what was that relation? How did they define it? You didn't have to be a Christian Scientist to report for the paper.
No, you didn't. When I was editor, I mean, we employed all kinds of people with all kinds of religious backgrounds. I mean, there were also Christian Scientists on the paper.
Sure.
But, we had a marvelous guy, Dan Seldon, who was a Quaker, who covered all parts of the world and was terrific. Now, having said that, I should be fair, there were times when it was made clear that the editor of the paper and probably the managing editor would be Christian Scientists. But even that varied somewhat.
First job, first beat was Africa.
Africa.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite a – they must have thought – or were they just desperate? They must have – I was going to say they must have thought something about your writing abilities, or maybe they just wanted
I didn't just get put it back on the boat and sent. I mean, you did a year or whatever it was in a newsroom while they found out what you could do. And, I mean, it was very humbling because you were starting from scratch again. But you had to write your way into the paper, and they liked some of the stuff. Like actually, Canham was one day the American news editor, a guy called Saville Davis, said, "Oh, we need a piece on the Victoria Falls." And I said, "I've been to Victoria Falls." And so I wrote a full page. It was in the feature section of the paper, full page of it. And Saville scribbled on the thing, with ringed white bylines, said, "One to watch," and sent it into Irwin.
Hmm.
Well, that didn't hurt.
Yeah.
And then when the Beatles came to the United States for the first time, I wrote the story about the first thing they did, which, writing about the Beatles for the Christian Science Monitor. But I did the sort of depth and where they were coming from and what they were trying to do and so on and so on. And their paper was that day was on in the middle of the Page One conference setting up. And I shot it in thinking, this is not going anywhere. Anyway, Canham liked it. And it ran on Page One above the fold. And then I knew I was on my way.
A lot going on in Africa, Ghana, the last days of the Belgian rule there in Congo.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of turmoil, which seems to be a theme in that era of your reporting, covering a lot of wars, a lot of conflicts. But you say in the book that you loved what you were doing.
Oh, yeah.
And said, in fact, you could hardly believe you were being paid for that.
Yeah, that's true.
What was it? Because were you drawn to the conflict stuff? I mean, what was the thing that you loved about it?
As a monitor correspondent, when I went to Africa, there were no independent – at South of the Sahara, there were no independent countries with the exception of white-ruled South Africa. At the end of 6 years, almost every one of those countries that are run by the Belgians, the Portuguese, the Brits, or the French, they'd all undergone the transition to independence. Now, it wasn't, you know, paradise after they, and there was a lot of messing around with dictators and bad guys and so forth and so on. And it was, you know, it has continued. There are things about Africa that are disturbing. There are things about Africa that are very promising. Even South Africa, you know, I never met Nelson Mandela because he was in jail for 27 years all the time I was there. Although, when he was finally freed and delivered this amazing speech, you know, urging compassion for the whites, and whites have got to stay and work with it, whereas he could have said, off with their heads, or at least under the boat, and you're on your way out. But this remarkable man I never met. But he did go to Boston, and he did ask to be taken to the Christian Science Monitor office. And he said, I wanted to thank you, to the editors there, because the only international paper I was allowed to read in my 27 years in jail was the Christian Science Monitor. And it did it heartened me.
Wow.
So anyway, that's a long story. But off I went to Africa and was there for 6 years and saw a tremendous transition. A lot of criticism and hostility from white South Africans, you know, because you were writing, you're telling the truth about what was happening, which many white South Africans didn't believe was happening.
You were in Moscow
yeah.
in 1962 with the Cuban Missile Crisis. Yeah. What was that like?
It was a little odd, thinking you might be killed by an American missile. But there was the monitor. The post was not filled by the monitor at the time, and I'd been learning Russian because they said, "We think your next post after Africa should be Moscow." As it turned out, I didn't go to Moscow; I went to the Far East. But I had I'd gone to Harvard to learn Russian. I thought would be a wise thing to do with a brilliant Harvard professor who taught. But he taught a group of about eight of us, and after the first lesson, you did not speak English. And so after about 3 or 4 months, we all spoke pretty good Russian.
At least you thought.
We thought. And the monitor said, well, okay, all right, got this crisis, hop on a plane, go to Moscow and cover it for us. And I got to Moscow and went out of my hotel and spat out in absolutely fluent Russian question to the passerby, who understood me completely and spat out a long answer and said, I couldn't understand a word of it. And then I realized you could only speak Russian with my Harvard professor, who didn't happen to be there.
You mentioned you were the Far East correspondent for the Monitor for 6 years.
Yeah.
And you also, of course, covered the war in Vietnam,
yes.
Southeast Asia. There's a great story in the book I wanted you to talk about. Lyndon Johnson, President Johnson at the time.
Yeah.
Summons you.
Yeah, I was back in Washington on a brief trip, and it's in the Washington Bureau, the Monitor, and this guy from the White House called and said, President Johnson would be really like to talk to you about Vietnam. And in my naivety, I thought, oh, he's intrigued about what I have written, ha ha ha, and wants me to tell him what's going on there, really going on there. So off I go to the White House. There we meet with President Johnson, and he starts talking and telling me about what he's doing in Vietnam.
Well, are you in the Oval Office at the time?
In the Oval Office.
Yeah. Is that pretty intimidating, right?
Not really.
No?
You know,
I mean, good for you.
It went on. I mean, he went on and went on. I couldn't get a word in edgeways. And finally, one of his assistants came in and said, got to stop. And Johnson didn't take any notice, just kept on talking to me. And then a few minutes later, I was slightly more anxious. A guy came in and said, you're to receive Prime Minister Menzies of Australia, who's a big ally in the Vietnam War.
Cut this short. Yeah.
And he still went on talking. And then finally some guy came in and said, you know, you could hear the 21-gun salute, you know, and you, you could hear the chopper coming to the when they just dragged him out there. And at that point, President Johnson said to me, I got to meet Menzies. You want to come out with me? And I said, well, I don't really think it would make much sense by going in there. Who would Menzies think this guy is standing next to? And moreover, who would the Secret Service think?
Yeah.
So I said, thanks very much. You know, great meeting you. Goodbye.
But he was interested in what you had to say.
He was interested in what I was saying.
Yeah.
No. He was pitching me.
John Hughes. This book is called Paperboy to Pulitzer, A Newsman's Journey, and we need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with journalist and now Professor John Hughes. He is a professor of communications at Brigham Young University. He's written a memoir called Paperboy to Pulitzer, A Newsman's Journey. Joining us here in the studio. Indonesia, your coverage of Indonesia, that's what got you the Pulitzer.
Yeah.
You were sent there in 1965. An ugly purge was playing out, an attempted government coup. Really genocide, I think it's fair to say, for the communists of that time.
Yep.
And you are one of the only at some point, you were one of the only Western journalists really covering that story.
Yeah. I was very lucky to get in. When I first went out to I was based in Hong Kong. It was hard to get into Indonesia, but I had a friend in an American embassy there who did a little work for me. And I did get a visa. And the trick was to make sure that you didn't – the trick was to get in, and the trick was to make sure they didn't throw you out once you were in.
Because they were throwing journalists out.
Because they were throwing journalists out. And they clamped down, and this was not in the era of the internet. This was in the era of cable and wireless. That's how you sent your stuff, and they pulled the plug on and everything. You couldn't get out. No phones, no way of getting your stuff out. And they could close the country down. They could stop you at the airport. And on your visa, you had the Wata one, which was in Bahasa for correspondent. You would kind of ticketed for special look when you arrived at the airport. So the trick was to make sure that whenever I left, I had a visa and from the foreign department, foreign ministry, a press card. And sometimes they worked and sometimes they didn't. But you planned your trip around what you thought was impending, what was coming up. So it was a question of timing.
Well, and then getting your stories out, you would give them to travelers who were leaving the country to deliver to your editors.
Yeah, when they really cracked down, it, when there was no way you get it out. I used to go to the airport because there were a couple of planes going out each day, and I'd look at someone and I'd say, "Please, excuse me, sir, where are you going?" And he might say, "I'm going to Manila." There was something in those days called carbon paper. You know, we could copy, so I gave him a copy, but I'm not sure about him. So I turned to somebody else and say, "Excuse me, where are you going?" "Oh, I'm going to Singapore. Would you mind dropping that off at Cable and Wireless office? And it's all paid for. Just don't drop it off."
Gosh.
And I didn't, because I couldn't talk to my office. There were no phones, there was no communication. So, for weeks on end, I was shoveling this stuff into the ether.
Hoping it ended up.
Hoping it ended.
Yeah.
I finally did not know whether two copies of my dispatch reached Boston, but I do know that at least one copy of that whole period, these dear people went to the Cable and Wireless and dropped it, and off it went to Boston.
You mentioned earlier in the program your wife, Peggy, is a member of the Mormon Church.
Yeah, sure.
Is that what got you to Brigham Young University, to Utah? Was that the connection?
No, that wasn't really the connection. The connection was I went into the government in the Reagan administration for a while.
Right, of course.
And my first job was at USIA. And my divorce of my first wife had broken up. And a young woman worked for me called Peggy Chu. I thought she was very, very, very impressive, very, very good. And then I had some trouble down at the Voice of America and said, "Would you go down and run Voice of America?" And I needed an assistant. There was a gap there. And I knew that Peggy Chu had a radio operating license. I said, "Well, why don't you come down and be my assistant?" She did. Then I went to State Department we sort of lost touch. And my divorce became final, and I guess I was back in Boston running Monitor. My Christian Times Monitor started a radio service, and I still ran that. Anyway, next time I went to Washington, where Peggy Chu was living, I said, "Let's come and have breakfast." And we had breakfast. And the next time I was in Washington, I said, "Oh, come and have lunch." And I looked at her hand, and she didn't have a ring on her finger. And eventually, we stopped talking about radio, and we talked about more intimate affairs.
Yeah.
And we got married. And she's been a wonderful, wonderful wife, and still is.
So this the idea of coming to Utah, that helped ease the transition some, right?
Yeah. Peggy had been at BYU. She'd had two degrees in journalism, and both print and TV. And so she'd been talking to the chair of the department, and he said, "Oh, we'd like John to come out and talk to the students." And I'd done it a couple of times, and not everybody walked out. And so they said, "Oh, well, that went rather well, you know." And then they said, "Well, why don't you come teach here?" And I said, "Well, I was doing other things. We'd gone and bought a little newspaper in Maine, and we were running that for a while. And then we sold it. And the guy with the Night Newspapers, who was a friend of mine, said, "We're sitting on a ton of money, and we want to do some things with journalism." And I said, "Well, I'm not sure we do the best training for guys we send abroad who become foreign correspondents. If you're the New York Times, you send a guy to Harvard for a year, and you know he learns all this stuff. But if you're the Cleveland paper or the San Diego paper and you want a guy abroad, you know, you send someone out and it's old Fred who did well at the City Hall and State House, but old Fred's not entirely sure which continent he's on and he doesn't know the background." And so there ought to be at some great university a kind of international mingling where we would bring editors and journalism professors from abroad, mix them up with students who thought they might want to be involved in international journalism, and everybody would benefit. But before I could get this idea to my friend, I got a call from the then chair of the department, Dave Forsyth, here at BYU. And he said, "You know, why don't you come and teach out here?" And I said, "Well, I'm just talking about this idea." And he said, I related this to him. And he said, "Well, we just had a retreat. That's what we've talked about doing. So why don't you come out here and run an international media studies program?" And that's how I went to BYU in the first instance.
Not so long ago, the Deseret News, the CEO there, Clark Gilbert, announced that the paper was going to pursue this different editorial focus, different from when you were the editor of the Deseret News, of course. Which is, I have to say, I've had a couple of people now reach out to me who you hired, who sort of referred to that era when you were editor as kind of a golden era. I mean, the really deep kinds of journalism, and you were trying these new different kinds of enterprises. But Clark Gilbert said that they're going to change their focus to faith and family. They want to own faith and family, Mr. Gilbert said, the way the Washington Post owns politics. So rather than sort of pursue this broad editorial mission that appeals to, you know, a wider demographic, the paper's now pretty much targeting Mormons.
Yes.
Do you find that troubling?
Well, you know, I have a rule that I never violate, that when I leave an institution I ran or worked for, I never discuss what the new guys do and the changes they make. All I would say is that my time was it was golden from my point of view. We had the chairman of the Board of Trustees, Mr. Snar, Glenn Snar, was a former journalist, gone into advertising, but nevertheless his heart was in newspapers. President Hinckley was extraordinarily knowledgeable about newspapers. I think he was a frustrated. If he hadn't been president of the church, I think he'd been a journalist. Because he just knew all about newspapers.
And well, what's interesting too is he gave you this edict.
He did.
Involve other religions, to talk about other religions.
But that was then, and now is now. And, of course, a lot has happened to print newspapers that is not good. The staffs on print newspapers are not what they were. The size of the newspapers are not what they are. And, you know, and in new circumstances, we'll look for new methods and new measures that are necessary to survive. Which is in essence what's happening to newspapers.
So you get that this is what's going on in the Deseret News, that they're having to. You don't want to trash their editorial department, but you do want to say I get that they're trying new things.
Yeah, sure, they're trying to do things a lot, you know, and it's not the paper it was when I was there. But you know, I had my day, and I understand that you know, we've got people who I love dearly who are not able to work there anymore. But it's not only a problem for the Deseret News, it's a problem for all print newspapers.
There's something you said. The Christian Science Monitor's board asked you to help make recommendations for the future of the Christian Science Monitor. And you ultimately, which I know this was hard for you, ultimately recommended they close the daily paper. And you said it was time for newspapers to accept a new reality.
Yeah.
And they're getting, you know, millions now of views on their website, whereas even at their peak, they were not even quite 250,000.
You know, it was not a great, it was not a huge circulation at times, but it was respectable.
Of course.
But when they asked me to go back and look at it, they were down to 50,000 subscribers. Well, that's, you know, and I couldn't believe that I would be making the recommendation to close the daily, but there was no alternative. But I said, well, you ought to keep your foot in print with a weekly. So we'll design a weekly for you, which we did. And now that's doing quite well. They took the 50,000 subscribers they then had for the daily, converted them to the weekly, and have grown the weekly to about 80,000, which is nice, but it's not what advertisers are looking for. You know, you've got to be much higher. So they keep the foot in print, but they have an amazing reach with the web.
So do you feel optimistic about journalism in the digital era? A lot of people are wringing their hands.
I feel optimistic in what I tell my students is certainly the method of delivery is changing, but the principles and ethics and the fun and the excitement of journalism remain the same. And I tell young journalists, get your foot in the door wherever you are, wherever you can, write yourself head off and don't be shy. And when you go in for an interview, we had a wonderful city editor, the Monitor, and we used to send people over. We didn't usually take people directly out of journalism school, but we sometimes took young people. And his technique was same for everybody. No matter how good the candidate was, oh, no, you couldn't possibly make it here. Well, if you said, oh, Mr. Dillon, I'm terribly sorry I took your time, and you picked up your papers and you moved away, that was it. But if you challenged him,
Stuck up for yourself,
because that's what he's looking for in a journalist. If you said as politely as you could, well, thank you very much, Mr. Dillon, but I think you're wrong, because I've studied your newspaper, and I've studied it, and I think I could do this, 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 that he liked. And that was a candidate.
John Hughes. This book is called Paperboy to Pulitzer, A Newsman's Journey. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
I should mention that today on Video West, we're going to be premiering a short from Utah filmmaker Dusty Hewlett, who was at base camp at Mount Everest back in 2011. On his final day there, he went to shoot the sunrise. He had one chance at it. Go see what he got at videowest.kuer.org. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.